This episode of Film Scene is being brought to you by our new Zazzle store. For logoed shirts, mugs, and stickers, go to zazzle.com/filmscene.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, it's showtime.
Welcome to Film Scene, the podcast for movie fans by movie fans. I'm your host, Tim Gordon, and joining me today is co-host Karen Gordon.
Hello.
Hi, Karen.
How you doing?
I'm okay. How are you?
You know,
I think we're all done with sickness in the house.
I think we're done with sickness in the house, but now we're dealing with, like, the new polar vortex.
In the house?
It felt like it this week.
Yeah, that's true. So today on Film Scene, we are going to go into our recurring segment, Movies We Love. But before we get to it, I have some collector news. I have some collector show dates that are coming up. January 23rd through the 25th is the Hollywood's version of the Hollywood Collector Show. You can find out info there at hollywoodshow.com. January 23rd through the 25th also is Portland's Comic-Con. You can find out info at wizardworld.com. February 6th through 8th is Madison Comic-Con, and info again at wizardworld.com. And one more, February 13th through the 15th is Indianapolis Comic-Con, and again, info at wizardworld.com. So like I said, today we are going to venture into our recurring segment called Movies We Love. Yeah.
That means I have to love this for you?
I think love might be a strong term. So the idea for this segment is that the whole podcast is going to be dedicated to a single movie, and usually these movies on this segment will be outside of our self-defined classic time period, meaning they will be post-1970, and the majority of these movies are going to be movies that have more of a cult following or are a sleeper rather than big hits. I think that's a good definition, right?
Okay.
So today on Movies We Love, we are going to talk about the 1980 film Somewhere in Time. This stars Christopher Reeve, Jane Seymour, Christopher Plummer, Teresa Wright, and directed by who?
We can't figure out how to pronounce it, so thank you, Jefferson City, Missouri Public Library for this.
Jeannot Schwark.
There we go. And I think we should note that the movie that this director did right before this was Jaws 2.
And correct.
And the movie right after this was Supergirl. So he had kind of a...
You can't win them all.
A notorious string of money-making bad films, maybe?
But actually, they felt like, for the studio, I was reading that Jaws 2 was actually their biggest moneymaker that year, and he was kind of rewarded by being given this film to direct.
Yeah, he kind of got to pick what he wanted to. Right?
Yes, and so that says a lot about the early 80s, late 70s, that Jaws 2 was somebody's largest hit.
What was the country's biggest hit, wasn't it?
Well, I saw the studio's biggest hit is what I read.
Gotcha.
1978, yeah, great year for fake sharks.
So the synopsis here is that Somewhere in Time is a 1980 romantic fantasy film directed by...
You're going to make me do it again? You got to give me a little more heads up there.
Jeannot Schwark.
He is French.
It is a film adaptation of the 1975 novel Bid Time Return by Richard Matheson, who also wrote the screenplay. The film stars Christopher Reeve, Jane Seymour, Christopher Plummer, Teresa Wright, and Bill Irwin. Christopher Reeve plays Richard Collier, a playwright who becomes smitten by a photograph of a young woman at the Grand Hotel. Through self-hypnosis, he travels back in time to the year 1912 to find love with actress Elise McKenna, portrayed by Jane Seymour, but her manager, William Fawcett Robinson, portrayed by Christopher Plummer, fears that romance will derail her career and resolves to stop him. It says also that this film is known for its musical score composed by John Barry the 18th variation of Sergei Rachmaninoff's Rhapsody on a Theme of Paganini.
Mm-hmm.
That also runs throughout the film. So you have some probably over-the-top music there, wouldn't you say?
I guess it's supposed to identify with the romantic genre. I bet this is the only Rachmaninoff that most people know, so.
Probably. And Rachmaninoff is misidentified in Willy Wonka, so don't go there.
I was not.
So, this obviously is a time travel movie of sorts. And I'm a sucker for time travel movies. That's part of the reason that I probably watched this movie in the first place.
I thought you were just going to say you were a sucker for...
For Christopher Reeve movies?
Yeah, Christopher Reeve movies and kind of lame romantic nostalgia, perhaps. You like a good nostalgia film.
Well, I do like the movies that have the non... That don't have the traditional happy ending, too, so...
So you're in for a thrill, folks.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert.
The interesting thing is this is a time travel movie with no special effects, so...
All those special effects were listed in the credits.
Yeah, which I don't understand.
What was
the effect?
When he disappears, apparently. Although you don't see him disappear. It's not very science fiction time travel, I think is what you're trying to say.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, it is in one way, but you expect there to be some kind of time machine or something.
This ain't H.G. Wells, baby.
Or, you know, someone gets hit on the head and wakes up 100 years later or something like that.
Hit on the head?
Yeah, Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court.
Mm-hmm. Okay. This ain't Mark Twain either.
So, yeah, there's a couple types of films that I will watch even bad versions of at least once. Time Travel is one. Life After Death is another. So, those are both pretty similar, I guess.
Mm. I watch it because it's funny. I'm probably the only person who finds this to be a comedy.
Well, and this particular movie, I don't think did great at the box office.
No.
Even though I think it was Christopher Reeve's first movie after Superman.
Correct.
But it has a pretty big cult following and even has its own fan club, as we discovered.
It does, which is pretty amazing. And if you've been on Mackinac Island, you know they sell all this stuff like crazy.
And I think the fan club helped get either Christopher Reeve or Jane Seymour or both their star on the Walk of Fame. So
that I didn't know.
That might be in your trivia somewhere.
I did not see it in my trivia. I'm sorry. I could go to their website if I were so inclined. But
so let's go through the points of this movie. Christopher Reeve, like I said, plays Richard Collier, who is at the beginning of the movie is a college student who has just written a play that's become, you know, kind of successful. They think it might go to Broadway. And the movie starts at the end of this successful opening of the play. And he's approached by this kind of creepy old woman.
Well, she's in very much in, like, still in her 1912 attire.
Yeah, period.
With the
garb.
Same hair.
Yeah. And
took her out of mothballs for the night.
You know, Christopher Reeve has never seen this woman before, and she puts in his hands a pocket watch, and all she says is, "Come back to me." And he has no idea what this means, and she leaves, and...
Those are the only four words that that actress who plays the older Elise actually says in the whole film. Which is really weird.
Yeah.
I was reading in my crazy trivia that as a joke a couple times, she's instead of saying the come back to me, she said, "Get it fixed, dear," and walked away. So, yeah.
So the watch becomes kind of a recurring thing throughout this besides
time.
Time, yeah.
I mean,
remind me to come back to the watch.
Yeah, it's a pretty heavy motif there.
So then the movie flashes forward 8 years, I believe.
Yes.
And Richard Collier is now living in Chicago. He's a successful playwright. He's just broken up with his girlfriend and is having kind of a writer's block on his latest play. So he wants to get away from everything. So he takes an unscheduled road trip and ends up at the Grand Hotel.
He takes a road trip to an island.
Well, in real life...
In real life, sorry.
In real life, the Grand Hotel is on Mackinac Island, which, side note, doesn't allow any cars, so they had to get special permission to have cars on the island for the film, right?
Yes.
But they don't... Even though it says the Grand Hotel in the movie, they don't say where it is or anything like that, right?
I don't think they ever make mention of it.
It is supposed to be within driving distance of Chicago, obviously, but... They don't really say where he's going.
Here's my first plot hole issue. He's driving a convertible to northern Michigan. Very few people in Chicago would want to have an open-topped car and then take it even further north.
Well, they don't even say that he's going north, though. That's the thing.
Well, and like all great Chicago shots, they show him driving into the skyline, so, you know, it's hard to tell.
Or leaving Chicago via Lakeshore Drive.
But Mackinac is far in northern Michigan, not in the UP, but about as close as you can get to being in, not in the UP, but being north.
True. Yeah. But like I said, they don't say that's where he's going.
Yeah, he's just out on a little 12-hour drive right. to Michigan. No big deal. And he never gets stuck in traffic.
So, while he's hanging out there at the Grand Hotel, which is supposed to be this very old place, he stumbles upon this Hall of History that they have at the hotel, which, I don't know, would a hotel really have such a thing? I don't know.
You know, knowing the Grand Hotel, it probably
does. Might, since they charge for tours and things.
I mean, you know, we stay at like a Holiday Inn, so I'm sure they don't have a
no Hall of History.
Historic Hall of Holiday Inn. Yeah.
And while he's there, this portrait that's hanging all by itself and has a ray of sunshine fall upon it catches his eye.
In a room with no windows.
Right. It just has a big skylight, apparently,
yes.
over that one portrait. It catches his eye, and he becomes obsessed with finding out who this person is. And luckily, when he checked in, he met this guy that had been at the hotel since... What did he say, 1910 or something?
Yeah, he's a totally befuddled old guy.
Since he was like 5 years old or something ridiculous. And he's only been able to work his way up to bellboy, apparently.
Yeah. Poor Arthur.
Yeah. Arthur is played by Bill Irwin, who you've probably seen in some sitcoms like Seinfeld and stuff like that.
Yeah, he's got some basic character actor traits about him.
He kind of looks like Einstein.
I think he kind of looks like Mark Twain.
They kind of look alike.
Maybe they're the same person. Maybe there's a real time travel.
So the nameplate is gone from this portrait, but luckily Arthur, who was built with the hotel, is able to tell him who the name of this person.
I find it amazing that someone of his age could remember that tiny fact. Like, she was just there yesterday.
Well, and apparently she was there when he was like 5 or 6 years old, and somehow he remembers that name. So...
What a bunch of weirdos.
But yeah, Richard finds out that the portrait is from 1912, not, you know, 2 years ago, like he might have thought originally.
Why would it be from 2 years ago? It's an old portrait.
True, but she has a contemporary look about her, except for the crazy bun in her hair.
There's nothing contemporary. He doesn't know what he's talking about, people. It looks like an old-timey photo.
So he decides to stay at the hotel even longer to try to find out who this woman is and everything about her. Visits the local library, where you can find out everything, apparently.
Yeah.
And he's, you know, looking through all these old playbills and magazines and things and learning all about Elise McKenna, who is the woman in the portrait, who was a famous actress in her time.
Which, okay, so he's a playwright. He's a college-educated playwright. She was apparently the most famous person of her time, yet he doesn't know who she is.
Well, I don't know that you would know that kind of stuff historically, especially someone whose career just dropped off the map. You know what I mean?
Fine. Be that way.
And he's shocked to discover that the old woman that gave him the watch is this same person, because he finds the last known picture of Elise McKenna, and it's that the same creepy old woman.
And I love that it's the last known picture.
Yeah.
Like, they're going to unearth a vault of Elise McKenna photographs from her later years.
Later than the day before she died.
Yes.
So, he also finds out where her last residence was. They don't explain
this
that,
this is
do
where
they?
It gets creepy for me. Like, he shows up at her door, he doesn't know she's dead.
Yeah, he shows up at this house to find out more about her and her caretaker, which we watched this yesterday again, I always thought that was her sister for some reason. That was just in my head, but I guess it was not.
That's completely in your head. I never thought that was her sister.
It was just someone that she lived with. And that character is played by Teresa Wright.
Correct.
I
would think if that was her sister would have known more, especially about who he was. But she
maybe.
Doesn't.
So Teresa Wright plays a character named Laura Roberts. He gains her confidence by showing the pocket watch to her. And Laura Roberts says that that pocket watch disappeared from Elise McKenna's possessions on the night that she died. So
Dun-dun-dun.
Putting two and two together, like the genius he is, he discovers that she died the same night that she gave him the watch on his opening play.
And this is what I love about this movie, is Christopher Reeve's continuous look of astonishment anytime anything happens in this film.
Yeah.
Again, supposed to be a bright guy, can't ever seem to see anything coming. And he always looks, oh, fascinated, confused, astonished. He goes the whole range of those three emotions through the film.
She kind of takes him on a little tour of Elise's room, which apparently hasn't been touched in the last 8 years.
Yet everything is perfectly set up for him to see.
Right. There's a little model of the Grand Hotel there, and they can open the top, and it's a music box inside, and it happens to play this Rachmaninoff piece that Richard declares is his favorite piece of music. So
yeah, so that he introduces her to right. at an earlier, later date.
And I was joking that it's a good thing he wasn't, a bigger fan of the Beatles or the Rolling Stones or something.
Something more contemporary, right. Yes, that would have ruined the whole mood.
And while he's there, he also sees that she had in her possession a copy of this book written by a former college professor of his, and it's a book about time travel. So, of course, he runs off and finds this professor again, and
Of course, willingly stops everything to talk to him.
Yeah, engages him in a conversation about if time travel is possible.
And it's got to be one of the most ridiculous conversations, non-scientific conversations of time travel. Like, if you're expecting Stephen Hawking or something out
or
of
some,
this guy.
Some Einstein theory.
Some Einstein theory. It ain't happening, people. It's very basically, if you just go in a room full of old stuff and pretend you're there, you'll be there.
So the professor's name, according to my info here, is Dr. Gerard Finney. Mm-hmm. Although in the movie, I don't remember them ever saying his first name.
They just show it on the spine of the book.
Okay.
Or the cover of the book.
Yeah, I just remember them calling him being called Finney. And he's played by George Voskovec, which I don't know this person.
I am not aware of him either.
He does okay in the role, I think, though.
Yes. And he also has quite a stunned look when, you know, asked right. out in the blue.
Is time travel possible?
Yes.
Dun-dun-dun!
He gives him the serious look.
So do you have info about, in your trivia, about the name Finney?
I read that it was, I believe, it was a nod to the author's, someone in the author's life, was it not?
It's actually another author.
Okay, I see here. He had written an actual time travel book, correct?
Yeah.
Yes.
Do you have the name of it? Because I actually have this book and I've read it.
Time and Again.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's a good book, and
so
it has.
He borrowed that. He stole the idea
yeah.
for this novel from the 1970 book Time and Again by Jack Finney.
There you go.
There you go.
Yeah, Richard Matheson is the author of the book that this movie's based on.
Correct.
And he wrote, his book is called
Bid Time
Return.
Yes. In 1975. So a bit of a controversy about who's lifting from whom's work.
Yeah, both books, the central plot element of time travel is that you can kind of hypnotize and will yourself back in time rather than actually having any kind of time device.
Wouldn't you wish for something better than to go back to, like, the Grand Hotel, though? If you had that power.
It depends on who's waiting for you at the Grand Hotel, doesn't it?
I guess.
Now,
it just seemed like he was overly specific in what he wanted to time travel for.
In that other book, it's kind of a government program that's training these people to do this time travel in order to go, you know, thwart things in the past that they want.
Okay, that sounds a little more sci-fi.
Yeah.
Than this.
But it's the same kind of thing where, you know, they kind of just will themselves back. So, yeah, like I said, that central idea is there. So, you know, Richard Collier, Christopher Reeve, gets this info from Dr. Finney. Because Finney explains how one time he was in, is it Venice?
I believe. He was in Italy in the 1500s.
Yeah, at some really old hotel and, you know, kept repeating this in his head about how he was back in 1500s or whatever.
And if you just hide all the new stuff in the room, apparently it works.
Well, that's why that's why his experiment, he said it didn't work completely because there were items around that reminded him of the present time too much. But he says that he thought that he was there for an instant.
For at least a few seconds.
But that he never tried it again because it drained him so much.
Yet he wrote a whole book about it.
I'd like to know what that book was because it was pretty lengthy.
It looked like a big instruction manual.
Yeah.
You know? Yet, and he didn't seem to be like enthusiastic about even sharing this information with Collier.
Like, well, he did it, though.
He did, but it was like, why are you bothering me? This is a big secret. I don't know.
So Collier gets the idea that he's going to go try this and will himself back in time so that he can be with Elise McKenna, who he's fallen in love with via this portrait, right?
Correct.
So he goes and he buys some vintage clothing, hullabaloo or something, I guess.
I know. You really should say hullabaloo like people know what you're talking about.
That's just fun to say.
I know. It's a used clothing store, people, in St. Louis. It used to be there. I wonder if it's still there.
So he also exchanges his money to get some money from the time period. Does he do any other things, clothing-wise or anything?
Well, clearly he takes the pocket watch with him.
Right, right. And in his room, he...
cuts his hair.
Right,
that's
right.
That's important.
Yeah, he tries to cut his hair in whatever a 1912 haircut is, but it looks pretty much the same as it did before.
Yeah. And apparently he's an expert barber, because he doesn't screw it up like most guys would with a pair of scissors standing in a hotel room.
Must have had the Flo-Bee.
I know. Yeah, his hair looks the same.
So he hides the pictures and TV that were in his room and tries to hypnotize himself via a tape recorder.
Again,
dummy.
Brilliant.
And, of course, this doesn't work.
Shocking.
So, you know, he's kind of given up a little bit, but he's still obsessing over this picture that he keeps visiting in the Hall of History. And he notices in there that they also have an old hotel register. So he goes and bothers Arthur again in the middle of the night to try to find out where all the other old registers are. Finds the one from 1912 and finds his own name.
And he finds it in the attic in about 30 seconds.
Yeah.
Didn't know it. Nobody knew it existed. Walks right up there into the dust. There it is, 1912. Look at that.
Must have all been very well cataloged in the attic.
And turned to the right page, found his name.
Do you think any hotels really have an attic, by the way?
No. No.
So, realizing that he had been there, he, re-hypnotizes himself with renewed interest, realizes what an idiot he was for trying to use a tape recorder, which is obviously a modern device, and squirrels that away somewhere under the bed,
Yeah.
And, eventually is able to conquer this time travel and winds up where he wanted to be.
Yeah.
Even on the right date.
Well, he had to be very specific.
I guess so.
He was telling himself the date. Repeatedly, so.
So while he's back, he is able to introduce himself to the actress, Elise McKenna, played by Jane Seymour.
Eventually, yes.
He finds her. And her first line, "Is it you?" kind of doesn't make sense, but it's become classic for this movie, I think.
I guess.
She had been warned at some point by her manager that a man would introduce himself into her life and try to take her away.
Okay, so...
And that's why she says that.
I have to stop here and just wonder, you know, was it just the obsessive nature of her manager knowing that at some point there's going to be a battle here with some dude and her life with the manager? Or does he actually have some premonition of this?
I think the manager was just obsessive in wanting to keep all outside people away from her, especially a man that might cause her to, you know, just get married and start a family and abandon her acting career.
So there was no premonition here.
I never took it that way.
Christopher Plummer didn't have some magic power to know what was coming.
I never thought that, and I never thought she did either, although I can see...
I thought she believed that he did, though. Like, I think she was dumb enough.
I can see where people would think that she thought that he was coming from someplace.
I don't know.
So, of course, they immediately fall in love just by looking into each other's eyes.
Of course.
Just like in real life.
Yes. Total stalker comes up to you.
Yeah. She eventually agrees to spend an afternoon with him, and that's when they fall in love. Right.
I guess that's all it takes.
They visit a lighthouse close to Mackinac Island and go to a gazebo that's still on the island somewhere.
It is. They moved it to Fort Mackinac. Uh-huh. It's no longer on the grounds of, like, the hotel, but they moved it to the fort. Why a fort needs a gazebo, I'm unclear. But it's there.
They had to protect it.
I guess. Protect the gazebo!
And that's about it. You know, they admit their love for each other, right?
That's about it.
He comes off as a stalker.
He totally comes off as a stalker.
Which doesn't seem to bother her. She must not have had much attention from guys before this.
I think it bothered her, clearly. Some weirdo shows up at your door.
But she liked the attention. She agreed to go walk with him.
I guess. Sometimes it's how you get rid of somebody.
Or not.
Or not, and they keep following you.
You know, all along this way, the manager, played by Christopher Plummer, tries to come between the two of them. Eventually, she has to go and perform her play there, close to the hotel, that, you know, the reason she was there in the first place, and leaves a ticket for Richard. He goes to the play, and in the middle of the play, she kind of goes off on this...
goes off script.
This little soliloquy of what love is about to her. And kind of dumbfounds everybody else in the play. But she gets it back on track eventually, right?
Oh, because she's an actress.
So the manager realizes what this this kind of threat is to her acting. And tricks Richard into being alone with him. And he gets kind of shanghaied, right?
Yeah. Agreed. Again,
they beat him up and tie him up and stash him away in some horse stables and tell Elise that he's just left. So
there you go.
Richard,
worst fight scene ever.
Yeah, he just kind of gets beat up.
He goes, oh, right when this right big guy. Gut. Yeah, and then they cut. It's like, oh, okay. He must be dead.
So the next morning when Richard wakes up, he finds out that the whole acting company is gone because they're moving on to Denver.
Of course, the next
theater
capital of the world.
And, you know, he's depressed as he should be, thinking that Elise has left also. But turns out she didn't leave with everyone else, and they never explained quite why. But.
Yeah, how'd that work out? She has nothing and no one, but she sticks around.
So they spend the day together and the night together, and looks like everything's going to be happy ever after, right?
I guess.
But... you know, she's kind of making fun of his clothes and his crazy pocket watch that she's holding on to. And he's showing off how great his suit is.
His ugly suit that he's also been rolling around in, like, horse poo in.
Right.
He's been wearing this thing for days now.
And he's like, look, it even has a secret pocket. And he pulls out a penny from 1979.
Da-da-da!
Which causes him to instantly disappear from 1912.
Stop. He doesn't instantly disappear. He does this crazy move where he reaches out for her, and she's squealing, Richard! And we assume he just, and this is the debate we had last night, does he just disintegrate? Does he shrink? Can she see, like, a little bitty light dimming, like, at the end of the tunnel he's going? I don't know.
I think in her eyes, he just disappears.
Why would you scream after someone who's gone then?
Well, maybe it wasn't like an instantaneous thing.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Is he slowly disappearing?
Like,
does
maybe
he just disintegrate? Does he leave a dust pile on the floor?
Well, maybe it looks like when...
Does the suit stay behind? I have questions.
Well, no. He's still got it on when he wakes up.
Well, I guess you can't leave your suit in two different centuries.
Because he sweated through it, remember?
Oh, yes. I forgot about that. He leaves this nasty stain all the way through this wool suit. He's never going to get his deposit back on that.
Yeah, I assume it just looks like when someone gets beamed up on Star Trek.
So they kind of pixelize and dissolve. Okay.
So...
And from that, she keeps wanting to know where he is? That freaked the hell out of me.
I guess so.
You know? Well, and he's a big liar then, too.
How so?
He never says where he's from. Like, in terms of time.
He says he's from Chicago.
Yeah, but he doesn't say when. So really, he's just a big fat liar.
So you're thinking people would believe that if you blurted that out.
Well, he had about 2 seconds to say, okay, and right when the penny comes out, too, he suddenly can't talk either. Like, what? He could have yelled, I'm from 79. He could have thrown the penny at her. There's so many things. He had options.
So he disappears from 1912.
Yes.
And wakes up again in his own time period.
Correct.
Really sweaty.
Very sweaty. Apparently, time travel makes you sweat.
Well, like Finney said at the beginning that... It was exhausting. I always assume that that's an effect of that, you know.
Sweaty?
Yeah. Don't you find being sweaty exhausting?
You never just come home from work and you're just exhausted but not sweaty?
That's different.
Do you have a sweat problem?
Maybe.
You have a glandular issue, apparently. This is the sweatiest movie ever for no apparent reason.
So he immediately tries to will himself back to 1912, but just can't make it happen, and... They never really explain why, if that's just like a one-way trip.
Yeah, like, can't he just go back?
Yeah, why can't he just bounce back and forth?
Because if the other guy only stayed for a few seconds, he clearly was able to stay for days. He's got a talent for time travel.
And this is what happened in the Finney novel. The person was able to go back and forth whenever he wanted. So.
Hmm. What if he held on to her? Could she have come with him?
Unknown.
Could he really ever die then? I just walked into that one.
So, you know, at some point he realizes he's not going to be able to go back. And he's kind of roaming around the hotel and the island and seeing the places where they had been together. And
suddenly the island is like a 1970s trash can.
Yeah, it's like a a trash dump. Well, maybe that's why he got so depressed. He's like the Indian with the tear running down his
That's
cheek.
That's what it looks like.
So,
and suddenly it's cold, too. Did you realize that?
Yeah.
Suddenly he's wearing like a heavy,
like a big sweater.
Yeah, jacket. Like, suddenly it's summer and now it's cold. How long were you gone?
So he's just getting more and more depressed.
Yeah. I guess.
Finally, he just sits down in his room in a chair, looking out the window at the lighthouse where he had visited with Elise McKenna. And, doesn't move again.
How fortuitous that he had that room.
Yeah, really.
Sometimes you just want to sit down and die. Is that the moral of the story?
And really, that's they don't really say what happens, except that, you know, the doctor and Arthur break into his room at some point and realize he's in distress.
Yeah, and, how did that happen? How did they know?
Well, just that nobody had seen him for a while. Oh,
they housekeeping, hello?
They said something about housekeeping saying that he hadn't moved in days or whatever.
Okay, wouldn't you, as a housekeeper, like, be freaking out after day one?
Yeah,
like,
maybe.
Like, day two, you're like, there's something not right with this. But let's go a whole week and see what happens.
So,
wouldn't he start to, like, fester and stink?
You would think so.
And, you know, he's not dead, but he's also, if he's not moving, there's other things that keep moving.
He's,
He's gonna smell like poo.
They place him on the bed, and there he expires.
He passes into the light.
Yeah.
Whatever.
And they kind of have a camera angle that floats above the room and...
out the window.
Out the window and off into the light. And there, at the very end of the movie, they show him reunited with the young Elise.
And?
And I say that because I thought it would be funny if he found the old Elise in heaven.
That would be great. That'd be awesome.
So that's the gist of Somewhere in Time.
Oh, yeah.
As we said earlier, this was written, a novel of this was written by Richard Matheson, who's a famous science fiction writer. And I've never read the book. Have you?
No. I am not a fan of science fiction or time travel.
The book was called Bid Time Return, but I think if you look for it now, it actually has the title of Somewhere in Time.
Probably had to.
Probably.
For monetary purposes.
And I guess the big difference in the book is that the character of Richard in the book is dying of a brain tumor.
That would have made more sense because he does some stupid things that only a brain tumor could account for.
Well, they never really say for sure in the book if he actually did time travel or not. Or was it all just something in his head because of this tumor?
Couldn't this all have been something in his head too?
I don't know. He was given a watch by the old lady.
So what?
They never really explain how...
Sometimes old people have dementia and they just give things away. They don't know who they're talking to or what they're saying.
They never quite explain how Elise was able to put all these pieces together and find him in present day.
I have a hard time thinking Elise was the smart one of the two. Although he was not a brain surgeon.
Now, some of the problems with this movie, why
there's
it's not
perfect.
There's
more than what we already said.
Oh, yeah. I think the overall look of it, it almost looks like a made-for-TV movie.
Yes. Well, and I think the production value just wasn't there.
No. For a long time, I actually thought this was a made-for-TV movie. I didn't realize that it was released in theaters. And part of that was because of the people that were in it, but just the overall feel and look of it, there's something missing.
Well, I think Jane Seymour probably being more known for her television and miniseries work as well.
Right. And this was Christopher Reeve, his first movie after, his first non-Superman movie, yes. I guess, right?
And probably the one he's most known for
outside of Superman.
Yeah.
I have a feeling that Christopher Reeve was a very good stage actor.
He emotes a lot.
Who happened to be the perfect Clark Kent.
Yeah.
And therefore got to do some other movies. And I don't think he's not, it's not that he's bad in this movie. It's just you can tell that he's a stage actor.
Kind of the same way of like Laurence Olivier being like that too.
Perhaps.
Like, I'm sure he was wonderful on stage, but on film he comes off as just.
Although I don't know that how Olivier would have been in Superman.
Okay, smart Alec. You know what I'm saying here, right? Like, there's that genre of, you know, British actors who crossed over, and yeah, you know who they are, but it doesn't play the same on film.
So one of the things when you're talking about time travel, and if you're talking about time travel as it applies in the real world.
Okay, wait. You're suggesting there's real world time travel.
Well, a reason people always give for time travel not being possible is the paradoxes that it would create. And the biggest example that people throw out is if, let's say, you go back in time and kill your grandfather, right?
You really don't like my grandfather?
If you killed your grandfather, then you wouldn't be able to be born.
So it's the Back to the Future theory.
And therefore, how did you go back in time to kill your grandfather? And it's just kind of a never-ending loop, right?
That you're putting a wrinkle in the whole thing.
Right.
Okay.
So this movie has a really big paradox that most people don't catch on to. Do you know what I'm going to say?
Okay. I'm going to roll with you here because I never know what you're going to say.
So at the beginning of this, the old Elise gives Richard this pocket watch, right?
Correct.
He has it for 8 years, at which point he goes back in time with the pocket watch.
Okay.
And he then leaves it with Elise.
Who's going to eventually give it back to him.
So where did the watch come from in the first place?
Well, yeah, this is one of those chicken and the egg situations. Because who met whom first? And how did that come about? And the watch and
who manufactured the watch?
What?
Who manufactured the watch in the first place?
I don't know. The watch is just a symbol. No, I hear what you're saying. Yeah. At some point, someone started this, you know, the ripple in the pond, and yeah, I know what you're saying.
But I think it's done well enough that you don't think about it quite that deeply.
I think about it because I find this whole film preposterous. And I mean that in the kindest way possible, because I know there are diehard people who love this film. I know my mother loves this film. Oh, it's such a sweet film. And she goes back and, oh, you cry. I find the whole thing so campy. And so, and this has always been my knock on Christopher Reeve, is there's just campiness about it. Like you said, I think he would play well on stage. Like, with an audience interaction, maybe that's what's lacking, but it's just...
Yeah, there's no good reason for me to like this movie.
Agreed.
Yet I do, and I can't say why. I don't know. Nor could I explain why other people like it so much.
I think other people like it because... There's the nostalgia factor, and you are always more drawn into nostalgia than I am.
Well, I don't have a strong nostalgia for 1912, though.
But I think anything that seems like it's trying to attempt some type of historical, you know, reincarnation, you love.
Well, yeah, like I said, I'm a sucker for the time travel movies, for sure.
I think you want to travel back in time.
And Life After Death, and this has both of those.
guess. I mean, it doesn't really have life after death. They don't come back.
And I do like the beginning of it, where there's just this kind of building mystery that goes on, too. There is something nice about this notion that if you are really drawn to someone, a soulmate, that even time can't stand between the two of you.
Are you a believer in reincarnation?
I don't know.
Well, I think you're saying that you are, but you're saying that sometimes your time frames don't jive up, and then all of a sudden, at some point, somewhere in time, in death, you will meet again.
Well, he even willed it to happen.
He basically killed himself at the end? Yeah.
No, I meant when he went back in time.
Well.
So what other trivia do you have that we maybe didn't touch on?
What would you like to know about?
I don't know. What do you got?
What do I got? Well, as we said, it was filmed primarily in Mackinac Island, Michigan. It was kind of a flop at the box office in the U.S., but allegedly was the highest grossing film in China and played in Hong Kong for 18 months.
Wow.
Do you attribute that, again, to a group of people who perhaps believe in reincarnation more than, say, a Judeo-Christian society?
I can't explain anything that's popular in Asia.
Okay, I guess they're responsible for Hello Kitty as well. Do you think it's perhaps because they were such big fans of Superman?
That probably didn't hurt. I'm sure that got this movie a lot of attention when it first came out. I did read something that Christopher Reeve's agent didn't even want him to read the script because they were offering so little money for this right after his big hit with Superman.
I did see that, and they had, it was one of those Hollywood stories of sneaking the script into
him. Somehow he got it and liked it and rolled with it. By the way, I do think they're not a bad couple on screen, even though overall they don't have that much time together.
I think it's hard to bear anyone with Christopher Reeve because he's so tall.
Well, I think they made this work, though, don't you?
I saw in here, too, that one of the possibilities outside of Jane Seymour was actually Bo Derek, which that would have played badly.
I can't imagine that. I saw that, too.
That's crazy. I don't see that.
No.
Yeah.
Especially if she's supposed to be in 1912. I mean,
I don't
she's
see
a
her
very
living...
contemporary person.
I don't even think she is, but I would have said, you know, she's a very late 60s to early 80s type of a person.
Yeah.
You know, beyond that, I don't see that. You did point out this to me, and I missed it last night when we were watching it. William H. Macy's first film.
Right.
Very tiny role as a critic.
Yeah, I don't remember really seeing him. I just know his name is in the credits.
And
I pointed out George Wendt's name in the credits. Although I read
his scenes were cut.
Yeah, his scenes aren't there, even though he's in the credits.
Yeah, I can only imagine what role he would have played in something like this.
Tim Kazurinsky has a small part as a photographer in 1912.
I didn't know that.
He went on to be on Saturday Night Live.
Yes, he was in that very brief stint with... what other notables was he mixed in there with?
Oh, maybe Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
Julia Louis-Dreyfus, yeah. And her husband. And
Brad Hall.
Brad Hall, that's who he is.
Might have been that time.
Apparently this was inspired, Richard Matheson's book was inspired by a dream he had about stage actress Maude Adams, perhaps meeting him up in time somewhere, and he kind of ran with that idea. I know, right? Did you know that?
And Richard Matheson has a cameo in the movie, too.
Correct. He is...
Astonished Man.
Astonished Man. Yeah, I mean, he's another hotel guest.
Yeah.
Who seems kind of shocked at the brash nature of...
Christopher Reeve
character.
With his old suit, and I think he sees him after he's cut up his face trying to use a straight razor.
Yes, absolutely. We were talking earlier that this is the only one of Christopher Reeve's first four films in which Ned Beatty does not appear. Could you imagine Ned Beatty in this?
No. Well, I know he's in the Superman movies, but I wonder, is that the only ones they're talking about?
I don't think so. There must be some others outside of that. Huh. When was Death Trap? Was that was after 82. Okay.
Yeah,
so that would have been after that.
I don't think Ned Beatty was in that.
I don't. Death Trap was so long ago. Again, a cable classic, but so long ago. It's...
Is that about it?
I mean, that's about it.
As we mentioned, this
Christopher Reeve did have a concern about taking this role. was that with the ending, he didn't know if they'd be able to buy into him dying of a broken heart since he's this super strong Superman person in other films.
I was just going to say, as we mentioned, this does have a fan club.
Yeah.
Which is, I assume it's still going, although I haven't heard anything about them in a long time.
It is still going.
They still have a website, for
sure. Yeah, it is somewhere in time. .tv. I don't know why it's a .tv, but it's a .tv.
Isn't their name like Insight or
yes,
something like that?
Yes, it's something like the, it's some crazy long acronym about being somewhere in time enthusiasts.
Yeah.
Who knew? And also, I guess, you know, going back to our little trivia, there's all kinds of apparently anachronistic goofs in the film. You know, modern touches such as fire sprinklers and things like that throughout aren't horribly off and don't horribly jump out at you, but there are small goofs throughout the thing.
I wondered about the electric lights even.
Well, they did say that one of the things that they said was at the time they would have been clear glass lights, not the more frosted, softer bulbs mm-hmm. that we've used since then.
Well, we noticed the paved road with the line down the middle, which I guess wasn't a thing yeah. at the time.
Well, and also the asphalt patches, too. I mean, if you don't know Michigan, the weather is pretty horrible, and that freeze and thaw, you know, you get potholes, and they do. It's not car traffic, but it's very heavy-duty horse and carriage and bicycle traffic. I mean, you and I have actually bicycled there.
Yep.
It's very hilly.
We did not bicycle so fast. We went back to 1912, though.
We did not. And I was the one with the toddler in the seat behind me, the 30-pound toddler going up the hill. But we did actually stop and look. And this was probably, more than 15 years ago.
Yeah.
Probably closer to 20 years ago.
The hotel's still there.
It is still there. And it is still a $500 a night hotel. And that
looks
was another thing that I saw in here was that because of the small budget, the crew couldn't even stay at the hotel. The cast and crew had to stay elsewhere.
I thought I read somewhere that the original budget for this was cut.
It was cut in half. Point. Yeah, so. It was an $8 million budget cut in half to $4 million.
That explains some of the look of the thing.
You know. Mean the actual film look of it?
Yeah, and the costumes and the set design.
And everything just looks cheap?
Yeah, there's just something, and I can't quite put my finger on any one thing. There's just something about the quality of it that looks TV movie-ish.
I'm telling you, it's Jane Seymour and the music. Makes it complete Thornbirds material.
I like the score for the movie. I don't care for all the Rachmaninoff because it's so over the top.
Hey, isn't this film just over the top?
Yeah, absolutely.
So it fits, right?
I don't know. I could picture something better, maybe. Maybe I just don't like that piece of music myself or something.
You don't? It gets stuck in your head.
True.
I know.
It doesn't mean it's good.
True. I mean, but yeah, there's all kinds of little things that just didn't quite fit the time. So
I thought I read something, or maybe I just thought this, that they're wearing hats inside a little too frequently for the time period, too.
Yeah, and at that time, it would have been a gentleman removes their hat indoors.
Yeah.
Even at this time period. It wasn't like today where you can walk around with a baseball cap on all the time.
And you brought up that this was the same year as the Titanic sank.
Yeah, correct. It would have been set just a few months after the sinking of the Titanic.
And I think that there are some websites that compare this movie to Titanic.
Well, in the going back and forth. Now, they don't travel in time.
No.
But they have a flashback, so.
And they have the life after death thing at the end, too.
And it's not a stopwatch, is it? No. It's her, her stupid necklace.
Yeah,
her 800-pound necklace.
She's got the diamond.
Yeah. Yeah,
the heart
diamond
of the sea.
And yeah, okay, wow. Somebody watched the Titanic a few times.
Sorry.
Somebody watched the Titanic. I'm telling.
So what else do you have, or was that the end of trivia time?
Well, you know, like I said, there's these little things that they didn't quite get the time period right, like the hotel flag, 50 stars. 1912, right? We didn't have 50 states. It should have been 46, I believe.
I wonder who freeze-framed that and counted.
You know, probably the people from the Somewhere in Time fan club.
Right.
Yeah, so little things like that, there's errors in.
Hmm.
You know, so, and I never watch movies that closely that I catch things like that.
So if you were remaking this movie today.
Oh, good Lord. First of all, why would I do that?
Who would you cast?
Wow. A modern day.
And if the budget was what it should be.
Wow. Okay, so what over-the-top male actor do we think we could...
Leonardo?
Oh, he'd be too old at
think
this
so?
Point. He's like our age.
He's got the pudgy baby face, though.
But that's not pudgy baby face anymore.
Joseph Gordon-Levitt?
Okay, I can see that one. I can see that, but he's not quite tall enough. I mean, you want someone tall and...
You could pick a short girl, too.
Okay, so what girl would you put in it?
Reese Witherspoon?
What?
Just popped in my head, I don't know.
Oh, I don't see that at all.
Emily Blunt?
She's too good for this role. Okay. No, seriously, I take her a little more serious. So you need a British actress who's not quite... And that was another thing you mentioned, that she was an American... billed as an American actress, but Jane Seymour is British and has a British accent through this whole thing.
Well, and they could have easily said she was a British actress and it wouldn't have mattered. You know, I don't know why they did that.
I don't know, but I am thankful that they didn't try to have Jane Seymour do an American accent.
Right.
She's not Tracy Ullman. I don't think she could get away with it.
Who's the actress from Pirates of the Caribbean?
Keira Knightley?
There you go.
I think she's too good, too. You need to find somebody kind of middle of the road, maybe not a, I don't know, Rosamund Pike from Gone Girl.
You don't think she's too good?
No. I think she would be just good enough for that, you know?
And then how about in the Christopher Plummer part?
Wow. So you want some, so kind of creepy old, again, British? Or not?
Doesn't have to be.
Well, I think British is a bit more sinister.
I think I've got it.
What?
Al Pacino.
No.
Christopher Walken?
No. Are you going to kill her at the end? Like, what is your point here?
It's supposed to be creepy.
Creepy in more of a intellectual way.
Hmm.
I need a creepy intellectual.
So...
Get central casting on
Jack
this for
Nicholson?
Me.
Jack Nicholson?
No. Oh, my God.
Am I going too old?
You're going way too old.
Tom Hanks.
You need someone... Liam Neeson.
He's too tall.
He could play the Christopher Reeve part. And then he'd be too old.
Not Tom Hanks?
Tom Hanks is pretty tall.
Is he?
I don't like it when Tom Hanks plays a bad guy. It makes me sad.
How often does that happen?
It's happened before. But he could wear that beard and mustache set from The Lady Killers.
There you go. And the crazy teeth.
I think he would fit in perfect then.
Yeah, I think we got it.
Let's
get to work on this.
I don't like Tom Hanks still. Hugh Grant. A sinister Hugh Grant.
You don't think
I like
he's too
it.
Young?
Hugh Grant is in his 50s, isn't he?
I don't know. Probably.
That's probably how old Christopher Plummer was, believe it or not, when this was made.
True.
He's got that, like you said, that snidely whiplash beard. Or mustache.
Yeah.
Not beard. Mustache. But in my final fact... allegedly, they're trying to get the Somewhere in Time musical to Broadway. Who knew that there was that big of a demand for it?
Now you know. Well, like I said, this has a large cult following. Let's just see if it's big enough to get people out into a musical theater environment.
You think?
I don't know.
Hmm.
In a musical, so much is dependent upon other factors, you know?
Talent.
Well, and can people buy... Are fans of the movie going to buy someone else in these parts? You know? Or is that part of why they like it?
I think there's a romanticism about those particular actors.
Yeah.
I think baby boomer women probably love this movie more than anybody.
You think so?
Think of our moms. Yeah. Completely.
So that is Somewhere in Time on Movies We Love. Huh?
Movies Tim enjoys and Karen tolerates.
That's pretty wordy.
Don't forget who directed it.
Jeannot Schwark.
There you go.
Schwark.
Schwark. Jeannot Schwark.
So, like I said, that will be... Movies We Love will hopefully become a more recurring segment coming up, and I have a list of potentials to...
Can it be a movie I actually love one day?
Maybe.
Okay.
Although I don't
Girl's
know,
Got a Dream.
I don't know that I can search out the depths of that mind that much to find one.
There's got to be one in there. I don't know. I'm pretty critical.
So that's going to do it for us. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to write to us at film.scene@yahoo.com. And check us out on Facebook. We're at facebook.com/filmscenepodcast. And we are at filmscene1 on Twitter. Don't forget about our half.com store, too, for great deals on books, movies, music, and games. Click on shops in the bottom left corner and type in TGOR1. And also, don't forget to rate and review us on iTunes. Until next time, I'm Tim.
And I'm Karen. I can't believe we talked about this movie for almost an hour.
Well, if you're still here, thanks for listening.